Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, rethinking fashion. It's easier than ever to buy cheap clothes that are designer knockoffs. In fact, that's how many of us shop these days, filling up our closets with the latest looks from places like Zara and H&M. It's fun and affordable and good business. But author Dana Thomas says the problems behind these brands are many, from rampant labor abuses to serious environmental degradation. Dana Thomas's new book is titled Fashionopolis, The Price of Fashion and the Future of Clothes. She joined me in the studio Monday morning. Dana Thomas, tell us what fast fashion is.
Fast fashion is the segment of the fashion industry where there are trendy clothes made at lightning speed in subcontracted factories by poorly paid people, sold for very little in chain stores around the world, thousands and thousands of chain stores. And they're the sort of clothes that we burn through. They're sort of the fast food equivalent to fashion.
How big an industry is it today?
It's enormous. Some of the big players do more than any of the major luxury brands. H&M, I think, does $18 billion a year in sales. That fluctuates. They're a bit, they go down. They've been down a bit. And Zara, I think, does about $20 billion a year. That's compared to Louis Vuitton, which I think does 10. So just to give you an idea of how big these companies are, it makes up for a major segment of the fashion industry. And it also makes up for a major segment of problems like filling our landfill. Of the 100 billion items made every year, 20% go unsold. A good many of those, I would say the majority of those, are fast fashion items because they believe in economies of scale. They make their money by overproducing, and then they just destroy it or they throw it away.
And how much of this is ripoff? How much of this is stolen from the major designer?
Oh, most of it. There are a few original items like Melania Trump's very famous Zara jacket with the writing on the back, "I don't really care, do you?" Nobody, I don't think, had put that on the runway. But generally, the fast fashion brands go to the fashion shows, or they don't even have to go. They just look at the Instagram and Facebook and Twitter pictures and films and YouTube videos, and they start stealing from those designers' work right away and then knock it off in a matter of weeks before the top fashion designers who are showing this week in New York Fashion Week or next week in London and Milan or after that in Paris even get their orders completed with retailers. The fast fashion folks have already put in production knockoffs of those clothes and they'll be in the store in a blink.
So the problem, as you see it in your book, Fashionopolis, is that we as consumers have gotten into the habit of buying these cheap, sort of almost throwaway clothes, and we go through them very quickly, and they end up in landfills.
Yes, ma'am, they do. Only 1% of our clothes are recycled for the moment, which is kind of crazy. The problem is that we've started looking at clothes as disposable. We didn't used to.
Right.
Clothes have never been so cheap as they are today. And I kept reading this and hearing this and going, how does that work out? And then I sort of had a ha-ha moment where I was reading The New Yorker from 1940, a wonderful profile by Lois Long, one of my favorite writers, about Hattie Carnegie, the great retailer of New York in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. During the Depression, she launched, you know, a ready-to-wear line called Spectator Sport. And she was selling those suits for $19.99 at the height of the Depression, the worst economic moment of our history. And that's the same price you pay today for a suit or a dress at Zara or H&M. Meanwhile, the price of ground beef has gone up how much, right? You know, price of houses has gone up how much? The price of cars have gone up so much. But we're still paying the same price for clothes. Literally, not, you know, cost adjusted, literally $20 for clothes. So I thought, this is the problem. You know, we used to buy one of something, and now we buy 10. We don't attach emotion to clothes like we used to. We don't invest emotion into them. We don't cherish them. We think of them as disposable, sort of like IKEA furniture is disposable, and sort of like so much more that we go through, plastic in general, is disposable. And we need to bring back the love of clothes.
It makes me recall how precious many of the clothes I bought back in the 50s and 60s. I was also making
clothes.
So that the investment in labor that went into those I used to wear for years and years.
And there's this cultural shift that happened because of two things. And this is why we are more casual about our clothes. First thing that happened was NAFTA. NAFTA came, and just like Ross Perot predicted, though not to the degree that he predicted, his numbers were kind of out there, he said that it would all flow to Mexico. I think his quote was, with a giant sucking sound. Jobs would go. And that did happen. Before NAFTA, we knew people who made our clothes. They were down the street. They went to our church. Their kids went to our school. It was something that you appreciated because you knew so-and-so was making something for you. Maybe it was cars in Detroit. Maybe it was cotton in the South. Maybe it was T-shirts in Florence, Alabama. Maybe it was suits and ties up in New England. But we knew people somehow connected to the business. And so it was community. But that community went away, and it killed some of our towns, but it also killed our, you know, we had nothing tangible to the industry anymore. At the same time, school districts started cutting home ec. Remember home ec?
We all learned
to sew, right?
Absolutely.
Even if we just learned how to sew a seam and sew on a button, even the boys had to take the classes in the 1970s when I was in elementary school and middle school. And we all learned to sew. Well, home ec, shop, music, they all went out as testing took over. So we also lost the knowledge of what it requires to sew clothes. So we didn't know the people making them anymore, and we didn't know how to make them. We didn't understand what it takes to make something. And so we just lost the appreciation for it. And it just seemed like another item that we could just buy and use and throw away. One of the things I talk about in the book is that I think is really important is we need to get to a more circular economy, meaning that we keep things moving around and around, recycling somehow, be less cavalier with them. But also we have to just start thinking about what it takes to create something and therefore respect it.
You talk about blue jeans as a really good example.
At any given point of the day, half the planet is wearing denim. Which is kind of a staggering thought, right? You stand around at a bus stop and you see most everyone's got jeans or denim jacket or some shorts on. And jeans are one of the dirtiest items we make today.
Dirtiest.
Dirtiest polluting-wise. Because in the old days, in my youth, we bought shrink-to-fit jeans. They were as hard as cardboard, and you bought them two sizes too big,
right.
And you had to wear them 6 months before you could sit down in them without getting some sort of like fabric burn on your knees, right? Because they were just so stiff. You're like, ouch, okay, I'm going to grimace, but I'm not going to let it show. And then they'd slowly start fading and cracking, and they'd get to the place you really wanted them to be super soft, just right. Well, now we buy them that way. This is about convenience, and I feel like one of our biggest problems today with the environment and pollution is that we are too worried about convenience. We put more emphasis on convenience over the impact. So the convenience of jeans is that we have our jeans washed for us now to that soft state in industrial centers. We have them worn out and sanded and rasped till they're breaking at the knees.
Exactly.
And we
more
don't...
Expensive
and
that
more expensive
that way.
And we don't do that ourselves. Well, people working on those jeans, I've been to the factories, they're sanding them and drilling them and rasping them by hand with machines that sound like drills from a dentist all day long, mostly not wearing masks, inhaling all these fibers, which is creating health problems for them and the synthetic indigo. They're washing these indigo jeans, water sitting on the floor of the factories. It takes 5 gallons of water to wash a pair of jeans to the point where it's soft enough for them to sell for you to buy, as opposed to you wearing them and breaking them in over 6 months. And then that water's filthy and it isn't recycled. It's just sometimes just dumped into rivers. There's a river in China that's completely indigo blue and nothing grows in it anymore because it's too opaque. It's just filthy. The good news is, and that's why I call this the Book of Hope, is there's a company in Valencia, Spain, that has come up with a system that uses far less water, down to one cup of water, and they'd like to reduce it to zero water. And they use lasers to distress the genes in boxes that have vacuum systems to inhale all the dust so the workers don't do it. The workers run everything from a clean room next door. It's a much cleaner system.
But more expensive?
Not necessarily. Every time a company brings it on, the price goes down, a bit like organic vegetables. And happily, Levi's has just signed a contract with this company. The world's largest jeans producer will be using only this Jeanologia system very soon for all of its jeans.
Tell me about how you got so interested in current conditions for the workforce after that horrible collapse in Bangladesh.
The horrible collapse in Bangladesh was about 5.5 years ago now. And, you know, we had heard about these horrible sweatshops for years. And, you know, sweatshops have been a part of the industry since the very first days.
Absolutely.
Since Richard Arkwright turned on the very first machines launching the Industrial Revolution, Cottonopolis in Manchester 250 years ago, there have been sweatshops. Except for a golden period in the 50s and the 60s where it wasn't the cleanest business, but they weren't sweatshops because of the unions and because of the Fair Labor Act. And thanks to Francis Perkins and the New Deal, and workers were taken care of and treated well before the offshoring exodus. There was that one period where it was apparel manufacturing was a good and safe business. But when it all offshored to these places like Bangladesh and Vietnam and Mexico and Honduras, there was no oversight. There were no safety inspections. And if they were, they were a bit loosey-goosey, where you had the same inspectors inspecting for everybody and was on the take. And inspectors had signed off on Rana Plaza not long before it had collapsed. But once I started digging around and saw how it had been built, you know, that it was a shoddy, shoddy building from day one. It wasn't something that had just happened because of all the machines rumbling all the time. You just said, right, there's a lot of corruption. There's no oversight. And, you know, there's no health and safety standards, really.
And we should say that that 8-story building did collapse in Bangladesh, trapping and killing over 1,100 employed by the garment.
And I went
factories.
To see some of the survivors in Bangladesh on the 5th anniversary. For the book, I really wanted to show readers this is how your clothes are made. Because we don't really know. In fact, many companies don't even know how their clothes are made. The supply chain is so fractured that they lose track of where subcontracting to subcontractors to subcontractors. They lose track of where their clothes are being made. So the companies who were called out producing in Rana Plaza had no idea they were producing in Rana Plaza, so they say. But that's what happens. And everybody's taking a piece of the pie, and the people who are working in the factory are earning so little. People sometimes say, we're creating jobs and lifting people out of poverty. But in fact, I've seen those people, and I've seen those jobs. And what we're doing is we're lifting them out of extreme poverty, but they're still very much in poverty.
After that fire, after Bangladesh, did the industry make some meaningful changes?
It did, with the Accord of Fire and Safety. And they've inspected thousands of factories and had tens of thousands of remediations, and the factories are much safer. I visited one of them. What struck me, besides it being spick and span clean, because that's what catches fire, is the filaments, the leftovers, things trailing on the floor. Cotton is a very flammable fabric. But the wiring was up in the ceiling instead of dangling down like it normally was. There's no exposed wiring. The best thing was that they even had on site their own reservoir and water pump. So if the building does catch on fire, they can put it out just like that. That's a big difference.
When we come back, more from Dana Thomas after a short break. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Dana Thomas. She's the author of the new book titled Fashionopolis, The Price of Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Tell me about slow fashion. What is that, and where do you see examples of it?
Slow fashion is like the slow food movement that came out of industrial farming and fast food. And it's about going back to the old way of doing things, but doing them in a modern way.
Give me an example.
There's a wonderful company in Florence, Alabama, called Alabama Channon. And it's run by a woman named Natalie Channon, who actually had started her career on 7th Avenue working for the big fashion machine. And she decided to go back to her hometown of Florence, Alabama, which had been the t-shirt capital of the world before NAFTA, and run her business there because it costs less to be in Florence, Alabama, so her overhead was much lower. She would get some sort of incentives. There were empty buildings to set up in, loads of empty buildings. So she uses only 100% organic cotton. It's all made to order. You go on her website. It's a direct-to-consumer company. So you go on her website, you order what you want. She contacts one of her sewers in Alabama. They come to the office. They pick up everything. It's a kit that's been cut and all set to go. They take it home and they sew it by hand and by machine. They sign it. And then it's sent directly to you within 7 to 10 days. Now, these clothes are expensive, but they're beautifully made.
And they last.
And they last. And when they finally do tire out, since they're organic cotton, you can put them in your compost, if you have one. Or the town compost, and they'll degrade and they'll nourish the earth. So it's a slower business.
Dana, you talked about cotton. What about synthetics? And how are they affecting this whole fashionopolis attitude?
Well, you know, synthetics as we have them today, think of them, the top sort of three or four we have, polyester, nylon, neoprene, rayon. Those are sort of the ones you hear about and use regularly in your life. Most of them have not been around even 100 years. The roots of all this was at DuPont Laboratories in the 1930s. They became part of our wardrobe during the war, when silk was being used for parachutes and for thread in surgery, and cotton and wool were requisitioned for uniforms. So what were our clothes going to be made of? Well, DuPont had this cool thing called polyester and another one called nylon. And we thought it was great. It was light. It was inexpensive. It was had a nice texture to it. It was kind of cool. You could print on it. With many of the inventions of the Industrial Revolution and then later the Second Industrial Revolution that seemed great at the time, nobody had the long-term thinking that maybe we shouldn't be making fabric out of petroleum. One of these days, those reserves will run low or will have some sort of lasting impact that plastic, which is what polyester essentially is, doesn't break down in landfill. We didn't have landfills in the 1930s. They weren't thinking that way, right? Plus, we bought less clothes, so there was less out there to throw away. But because it's so inexpensive, we buy more. We are awash in clothes. 60% of them contain polyester made of plastic. What we have discovered now in the last few years is that polyester releases microfibers in the wash when we wash them and when they're washed in the factories to begin with. And microfibers, plastic microfibers, are now being found in our waterways, in our fish who eat and drink in the waterways, in the Arctic. They are found in the ice of the Arctic and Antarctica. And last week I read a story that microfibers have now been detected in the rain in the Rockies. So you can have an organic garden in Boulder, Colorado, and it's covered in plastic. So we thought that fleece, for example, was this genius way of reusing plastic bottles, but fleece releases microfibers in the wash. What we can do to reduce this, I mean, first, A,
don't buy.
Don't buy and wear polyester. But that's kind of hard. It's sort of like saying, don't buy or use plastic. I tried to go 24 hours without using plastic one day as a test to see if it was possible. I think I made it 15 minutes. So what can we do to reduce this? We can do things like wash our clothes on the short cycle instead of the long cycle, because the more we spin them, the more microfibers are released. Wash your clothes with cold water instead of hot water. Same thing. The fabric heats up, the microfibers are released. And that gives our clothes a longer life, short cycle cold water.
Absolutely.
Than long boiling them for an hour. And wash our clothes less often. The CEO of Levi's suggests you never wash your jeans. Now, that might be a bit extreme. I mean, there's probably a point your jeans will be able to walk out of the house on their own, and you can then put them in the wash. But you surely don't need to wash them after everywhere. You know, at least go a week or two.
But with companies like Amazon becoming major fashion players, I mean, isn't this just going to grow? Haven't we gotten into that habit? And isn't it going to be absolutely impossible to break?
I don't think it'll be impossible. I think it'll be a bit like, I'm hoping with this book, it'll be a bit like the organic food movement in response to fast food and industrial farming. You know, Fast Food Nation, a wonderful book that was one of my inspirations, came out about 20 years ago. And when it did, organic vegetables were rare and expensive. And there were very few farmers markets. I'm here in Washington this week, and I went to the DuPont Circle Farmers Market yesterday. When I lived there in the late 80s or in the early 90s, there was no farmers market.
No.
So there's been this rise of farm-to-table restaurants. There's a rise of small farmers. We now have Whole Foods, and Whole Foods is owned by Amazon, which gives us hope because they took it and made it democratic. What I'm hoping with fashion and what I write about in the book Fashionopolis is that I'm hoping we won't necessarily beat down fast fashion, but a more holistic side will rise up and be equal at some point. So we have a fair choice and it's more democratic.
So tell us how you shop. And what you buy.
Well, already I wear my own things forever. My daughter has just inherited my old jeans, my old shrink-to-wash jeans that I was talking about. Well, they've been sitting in the back of a closet for years, sort of stuffed back there. And she's 19 and pulled them out and thinks they're the coolest thing ever. I've changed the way I shop since I've worked on this book. I now buy slow fashion. I buy organic cotton t-shirts or clothes when I can. I'm wearing Stella McCartney today, who's a very conscious designer leading the movement.
Expensive.
Expensive. But I buy one thing instead of 10 things. I invest in it. It's a good, simple black suit. I can wear the jacket with anything. I can wear the pants with anything. Old school, right? Remember
Absolutely. How
we used to always
Absolutely.
Do it? Change it up with a sweater, put a brooch on it. Can be an evening, can be a day look. And then I rent. Renting is a great alternative for clothes. When I had to go to the Cannes Film Festival this year to cover an event for the New York Times, I rented my dress because I knew I wasn't going to need a big black tie gala red carpet gown a lot, but I wanted to look fabulous. So I rented it for $200 instead of buying it for $3,000. And then I return it and somebody else has worn it. So it's in circulation. I consign on the RealReal. I gave them things. My daughter buys. I don't buy so much. So there's different ways. If you're tired of something and it needs to move out of the closet, you have options. If you want to dress up and you don't want to spend a ton of money, you have options. And these are all new options that didn't exist even 3 and 4 years ago, which I think is cool.
So ultimately, though, isn't it up to the industry to make the kinds of changes you're talking about?
Yes, and that's why the Levi's signing on with Gina Loggia is such a big deal and so important, because they knew that they were a contributor to this pollution and they have figured out a way to not have such a huge impact. The good news is many of these businesses are realizing finally that producing in a more green way, a more environmentally conscious way, is actually good for the bottom line. The economies of scale is an incredibly wasteful business model. You make things that you know you're never going to sell, and you throw them away. They're realizing now that thanks to things like the EPNL, Stella McCartney started this and pushed it through at the group she was in, Caring. The EPNL stands for the Environmental Profit and Loss Sheet. And they crunch the numbers, not only on how much money they're making, but also how much money it's costing them and the impact they're having. And they're seeing where their impact is. And when they reduce the impact, they save money. So it's better business. And it just to prove that this fast fashion business and the economies of scale isn't necessarily working, one of the most famous and well-known fast fashion companies, Forever 21 in California, is teetering on bankruptcy. So you don't always become the second richest person in the world. You could also go bankrupt. And maybe it's because the tide is shifting, it's turning.
What is your general message to all of us as we think about clothing?
Do just that. Think about it. When you want to buy something, have a long think about it. Do you love it? Or is it just something that looks cool and maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work? Fall in love with clothes again. Let's have a love affair with our closet. I remember when I was a teenager, the first major item I bought was this really cool jacket that was like what Roger Daltrey used to wear on stage with fringe and suede. And I was babysitting at $1 an hour. So I saved my money. I went to B. Altman. I put down a deposit and I put the coat on layaway. Remember layaway?
Of course.
And I babysat really bratty kids for $1 an hour until I made more than $100. That's a lot of babysitting.
I should say.
To get that coat. And I kept going back to the store and giving her more money every few months and back and giving her another 20 or another 30 bucks until I finally had the coat. That coat is still in my closet.
How wonderful.
So that's what I say. Invest, earn it, love it, cherish it. If you can keep it, keep it. We're seeing this week in New York, the 80s are back. I keep hearing the 90s are back. I'm like, well, good, because I still have all my 90s clothes in the closet.
Dana Thomas, thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's been wonderful to be here.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Urib-Lipker and Josephine Neonai. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.